Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Center for Science and Culture. Today we're featuring part of the Q&A from the national book launch of Jonathan Wells' latest book, Zombie Science, More Icons of Evolution. This was recorded at the Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle and features CSC senior fellows Dr. Jonathan Wells and Dr. John West.
So now is the time for you all, because we're going to do some Q&A, and the way we do it is you need to go to that microphone, try to be succinct so that more people can ask questions. And I think we're going to have lights on us here, maybe not. Oh yeah, that means we can't see any of you, but at least
you're protected. We can't reveal your identities.
The other thing that I'd ask is, just realize that this is being videotaped, and so if you ask a question, you may end up being on the internet at some point. So just be aware of that. And while people are thinking their thoughts and getting ready to ask questions, I thought I would just add a couple things that I didn't include in my introduction because I wanted to get to some of the more personal things. But Jonathan Wells is a senior fellow at the Center for Science and Culture, and he has not one but two PhDs, one in molecular and cellular biology from the University of California at Berkeley, which you heard talked about earlier, and one in religious studies from Yale University. So being someone that only has one PhD and not in the scientific field, I sort of have PhD envy or something. I don't know, for someone that has two PhDs. He also worked as a postdoctoral research scientist at UCal Berkeley for a number of years after getting his doctorate. So, and has published in peer-reviewed journals and other things like that. So he knows what he's talking about, even though one other trait that I'll give you is he writes really with a deceptive simplicity. When you read his work, he can make even the hardest scientific concepts clear in an accurate way, and with no disrespect to any other scientists in the room or elsewhere, that is a rare trait among scientists. So with that, I think we have someone who's ready to ask a question.
Thank you, Dr. Wells. Question I have is that very last slide that shows here comes the sun, and every one of those particular examples involved universities outside the United States. A lot of the articles I read are from the London Daily Mail, and all these neat stuff is happening overseas. Is that just my perception wrong, or you know, this good thing at the end? Are with the U.S. going to be at the end of this and be worse? You know, and is all this education and stuff coming from outside the U.S.? I'm just curious.
Excellent question. Actually, there are universities in the U.S. that are engaging in some of these research projects, but we cannot disclose who they are. Because unfortunately, in the U.S., the establishment is so virulently anti-intelligent design. I think perhaps because so many Americans are religious and the scientific community wants to keep them from meddling in science. I'm just guessing there. There might be several reasons, but it's true. In the United States, it seems harder to get a public foothold, but privately, things are happening. Good things.
Hi, Doc. I know you're an expert on embryology and stuff, and you were talking
about... I'm an embryologist.
Yeah.
Expert scares me.
I know you're an embryologist and would never claim to any expertise that you don't have, but I read recently about experiment in embryological development where they were actually removing DNA to see what could happen developmentally from other sources, but I wasn't clear as to exactly what was concluded or what happened there. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not sure exactly which study you're referring to, but we've known for a long time that some things in embryos are redundant. That is, there are backup systems to make up for things when something fails. I mentioned some embryos develop normally even after their DNA is mutated. Mm-hmm. That's because other parts of the embryo make up for the defect. So I don't know the specifics of this work you're talking about, but embryos are really amazing. A frog egg will always develop into a frog if it survives to maturity. Never anything else. We can kill it. We can deform it, which I have done, sad to say, but that's it.
Could you amplify on that? Because I think, I don't know, this is probably different than what you're saying, but you did actually in your research with the frog embryos did something like that of taking out DNA and seeing what would happen. And didn't it develop to a certain standpoint, showing that there is something else going on, even heritable information that's not just in the DNA?
Yes. Frog embryos, sea urchin embryos, possibly a few others. You can actually remove the DNA at the first cell stage, and they will develop several stages after that without any DNA at all. At some point, they die because the embryo needs the DNA. But obviously, there's a lot more going on than the DNA.
So there was definitely something going on outside the DNA because it was taken out, and still they made it a certain... And was it positional or any conclusion as to where that's coming from yet?
All of the above.
Thank you.
Dr. Wells, I really applaud you. You have a way of putting the cookies on the bottom shelf.
That's good. I like cookies.
Earlier in your presentation, you made reference to micro and macro evolution, and those terms bother me a little bit because it tends to imply that the only difference between them is quantitative. And I don't think you would even agree that that's the case, but you had speciation listed under the category of macroevolution, and a species is kind of a contrived term. To my understanding, it has to do with whether organisms will reproduce together as opposed to whether they're genetically compatible. In other words, can you hybridize them and so on? So with that contrived definition, should it really be in the macroevolution category? It seems to me that speciation can happen by genetic, we'll call it division or subtraction, never addition or multiplication, that you can split up species that will not reproduce together. But that's all you've done is you've removed information, genetic information. Would you comment on those thoughts?
Well, as for the micro-macro distinction, that was made by Theodosius Dobzhansky in the 1930s. And you're right, it does smack of quantity rather than quality. But I think for Dobzhansky, it meant quality, actually. There's a qualitative difference between changes within existing species and the things that characterize the evolutionary record. Regarding new species, you're right. Species is a very tricky term. In fact, there are over two dozen definitions of species right now being used by biologists, one of them being the one you described, that is populations that are reproductively isolated from each other. We scientists, not me, but scientists have shown that plants can sometimes be hybridized. Usually the hybrid is sterile, but sometimes the chromosomes double in the hybrid, and then the plant is fertile, and that can be considered a separate species. That has happened. But species that arise that way are not on the road to open-ended diversification the way Darwinian evolution requires. Speciation by variation and selection, to my knowledge, has never been observed. So I think speciation is a problem for Darwinian evolution. But if a new species were to arise by variation and selection, well, then we'd have to consider the evidence. I just haven't seen it yet.
Dr. Wells, I wanted to ask you about biomimicry and any other
biomimicry.
Evidence where intelligent design is useful for science. I think we sometimes think we're just critics and we want to naysay evolutionary theory, but I like the video we had on the form to fly, for example, for discovery was very good in that. In fact, we're useful to science. Critics are useful. Do you have any other examples of design that where we've been able to show help science? Because we're not just critics, right?
Well, I think science should benefit from criticism. In practice, as I think you know, they tend to dismiss criticisms from people like us without even considering the content. I think there should be more of that.
Well, you described one example, did it come in your book about embryology, about how all the information, not all in the DNA, right? So that would be important contribution.
I think Jonathan is too modest. This is one of his virtues, but it's also a vice. So, for example, although he noted that many of the textbooks still recycle things, there were actually a number of textbooks that actually got sufficiently embarrassed that they had to remove some of the icons, including the one by Bruce Alberts and by the Nobel Prize winner, you know, James Watson. So one thing I'd say, Icons of Evolution itself showed a positive influence on trying to make the scientific community as a whole more honest in how they presented the evidence. And then another one, another book that Dr. Wells wrote just a few years ago was called The Myth of Junk DNA. And that whole story has been told by Jonathan Wells, but is a great example of where you had critics of neo-Darwinism, like our fellow Richard Sternberg, mathematician Bill Dembski, who in the 1990s was actually saying, well, in a Darwinian perspective, yes, you could expect to have massive amounts of this junk DNA that sort of left over the blind dead ends of evolution. But if you think that things show evidence of design, you don't just want to write off DNA just because it doesn't code for proteins as being worthless or junk. And so he actually predicted, based on intelligent design in the 1990s, that the so-called junk DNA may well turn out to be functional. And the story about how that is in fact turning out to be the case, Jonathan Wells wrote a number of years ago in his book, The Myth of Junk DNA, which itself was cutting edge because many Darwinians, you know, scoffed at that book and said he doesn't know what he's talking about. But in fact, a number of them aren't doing that anymore. There are still some diehards, I think, supporting junk DNA. But even someone like Francis Collins, who used to be a promoter of junk DNA, doesn't like to use the term anymore because the evidence is so overwhelmingly gone in the other way. So I think that in and of itself is another example of where design-based thinking was positive. And then even just more generally, Jonathan, I think you've talked about, I know Steve Meyer and others have talked about, and our friend Scott Minnick at the University of Idaho has talked about, that science itself really is based on a design paradigm. When you're trying to understand what something is going on, you're often reverse engineering a system. Well, you're treating it not as a collection of haphazard parts where you try to dismiss things that don't work. You're actually using the design perspective to understand things. Whether you're a blind Darwinian or not, you're forced to that way of looking at things just to understand the way things work. So I'd sort of almost turn it around the other way, is that what science can go on without the design perspective? And maybe you have some...
Sure. I think maybe... I'm still not sure I understand what you're asking, but I did use a design framework to probe the evidence for the sufficiency of DNA and find lots of evidence that other things are necessary in the cell, including spatial information. To follow up on what John said, our friend and colleague Paul Nelson has said in the past that Francis Crick, who was a great scientist, his work led to the discovery not only of the structure of DNA, but of the mechanism by which DNA makes RNA, makes protein, and so on, which is not as neat as has been made out to be, but he made some very useful predictions there. He also argued that most of our DNA is junk back in the 1980s. So Paul Nelson's point is that when Crick thought like a design proponent, like an engineer, he made great discoveries. When he thought like an evolutionary biologist, he was dead wrong.
Right.
You've been listening to Jonathan Wells and John West answering questions from the audience at the National Book Launch for Zombie Science, More Icons of Evolution. To learn more about Zombie Science and other books by Jonathan Wells, visit iconsofevolution.com. That's iconsofevolution.com. And you can buy Zombie Science online from amazon.com. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.